aisles from both sides. They ran to the stage while we were chanting the last few words of our chorus, chasing Snoop Dogg and Dr. Dre. Snoop, who was with his crew, the Eastsiders, ran out the back exit while his boy, Trey D, stayed and fought a handful of Death Row dudes whipping their asses all by himself. The Shrine Auditorium turned into pandemonium, with small fights breaking out in the crowd. Heading back to the hotel room on Sunset, I thought, I wonder if Lil' Kim and them are okay. So I called Kim, and she said that I should come hang out at a hotel later. Twin, DeLorean, Mr. Bars, Freeha, Draws, Gotti and I hopped into a van to the Swiss Hotel by the Beverly Center Mall, where Kim and her friends were drinking frozen apple martinis in the penthouse suite. In her room were D-Rock, Gutter, C's, Banger, and other Junior Mafia members, plus five of Kim's female friends. Her hotel room was crowded, so Freeha got one of her girlfriend's numbers and then we left. On our way out of the lobby downstairs, Kim's hairstylist ran out of the elevator calling my name. Pete, Kim wants you to come back upstairs. I told my boys to bounce and send the van back to pick me up later. Back inside Kim's room, I noticed that Junior Mafia was gone, and it was just Kim and her girlfriends plus the hairstylist. Kim poured me another apple martini, and we stepped onto the balcony to talk privately. I grabbed Kim by the waist and started kissing on her neck. I thought about Mary J. Blige and decided to play this situation differently. Stop, not right now, Kim said. There are too many people up here. I understood what she meant, but I kept trying to sex her right there on the balcony. After 5 minutes of us feeling on each other, I fell back because it was obvious she wasn't trying to let me hit right then and there. But the thing she told me let me know for sure that I can get with her at some other time. Kiki always thought Kim and I were sexing, but it never happened. When Kiki first heard the Quiet Storm remix featuring Lil' Kim, out of jealousy, she told me, that song is whack. After an H&IC promo tour throughout the tri-state area and down the East Coast in October 2001, I took a bunch of my boys to Puffy's restaurant, Justin's, on 21st Street in Manhattan, down the block from Soundtrack Studios. Drinking champagne while checking out the scene, the rapper Queenpin spotted me and asked me to dance. More the type to lurk in the cut, watching my surroundings, I wasn't big on dancing. But for Queenpin, I made an exception. While we were grinding on each other, she started sucking and tongue-kissing my ear. I was a bit shocked. We had done a song together a year or two earlier, but it was strictly professional. After she molested my ear, the DJ made an announcement. Big shout out to Jay-Z and Jermaine Dupri up in the spot. I see y'all. I walked over to my people. Where's Jay-Z? I asked, surveying the shadows of Justin's. I don't see him. So we lined the front door of Justin's on both sides. We weren't gonna let Jay-Z leave without dealing with us first. Yo, P, we gonna beat the lips off Jay's face soon as we see him. Godfather Nitty and Nitty's cousin Kiko all assured me. Kiko had a gun on him and wanted to shoot Jay. No, it's not that serious, I said. We just gonna beat him up. Gonna pull that gun out. Through the crowd, I saw Jay and Jermaine walking with three bodyguards towards us. Jermaine Dupri was aware of my beef with Jay and visibly shook, started speed walking with his bodyguards when he saw me. He quickly hightailed it out the door. Jay-Z spotted us lined up at the door waiting for him. Then from about 2 yards away, he extended his hand to shake mine. It ain't no beef, Jay said. It's just music, man, no drama. Oh yeah? I said, shaking his hand. I just wish you would have spoken to me before you said those things about me in the sauce, he said. But it ain't no beef, all right? Yeah, okay, cool, I said, and let him walk out the club. Keep in mind that I let him walk out. Queenpin is my witness. I could have changed Jay's future that night, but I chose not to. Jay put the white flag up, and his cop-out made me instantly realize that he wasn't no threat. He's just a big stuffed animal, a camel to be exact. I got serious beef with real gangsters. Jay's just a waste of my time. A few days later, I heard that Mike DeLorean and his boys from QB had broken in the Hab crib and stole his sampler, keyboard, PlayStation, and even a framed portrait of Havoc hanging in the living room that Hab later found under the porch. Then, they walked around Queensbridge asking people if they wanted to buy Hab stuff. How stupid can you be? A week after the break-in, I saw DeLorean sitting in a brand new black Excursion. I traded in the Benz you gave me for this, he told me. I asked him if it was an even trade. No, he said. I still owe $15,000. The blue Benz with the TV inside and 20-inch rims that I gave him as a signing advance was totally paid for. Then I looked at his neck, and I saw that the infamous records chain I got him with Ron Artest's invest money was missing. I sold the chain because I had to put the money down to get the truck, he said. So you sold the chain and the Benz to get a truck that you can't afford? And you robbed Hab crib? I said. What's wrong with you, man? You just fucked everything up for us. I severed my ties with Bars and Hooks. How stupid could you be? At the end of 2001, I received my certified gold album plaque for HNIC. Havoc only produced 2 songs on the HNIC. Not because I only wanted 2 beats. I was forced to find other producers because Havoc wasn't showing any excitement or enthusiasm about my solo project. I wish Hav would have done the whole album. Shortly after I got my gold plaque, Bags went to go check Havoc at Freeport. After the break-in, Hav's uncle, Lameek, gave Havoc 2 pit bulls, Black and Blaze. They ran loose in the yard and barked at all who passed by, especially mailmen and delivery people. We walked up to the gate surrounding the house, and the dogs went bananas, acting as if they wanted to kill Bags. They looked crazy. Hate and fury filled their faces, barking like never before. Bags couldn't even come inside the gate, because I couldn't control them. And when Havoc came out, he couldn't either. Hav had never met Bags before, so he came to my truck and made small talk. We were in the area, so I just wanted to introduce them. Bags and I drove back to Queens, parked in front of Majesty's crib in Hollis. We sat in Bags' Navigator and played PlayStation for a while. I'm gonna come get you early in the morning so we can start working on that mix CD together, I said. Cool, he said. Call me when you get up. I hopped out the Navy and into my truck and went home early for a change. The next morning, I called Bags around 11 to see if he was up and ready. Somebody else picked up his phone.
E?
I asked, confused.
No, this isn't E. Who's this? It's P. Let me talk to Bags. This is Detective.
Can't remember.
You'll hear about what happened to E soon.
I hung up quick. Oh, shit. Did they kill Bags like Green Eye said? I wondered. Nah. Maybe he got locked up or something. I couldn't reach Majesty on his phone, so I went to his crib later that evening. Majesty and a few others were sitting on the steps in front of his door with a big bottle of Hennessy in plastic cups. Madge explained that his family was having a cookout earlier that day in his backyard. Bags had parked his new Navigator next to the house, as usual, and they took a smoke break in the Navy because they didn't want to burn the weed in front of the kids in the yard. Madge ran back to the house to get a plate of food before it was all gone. And while he was filling up his plate, 4 masked gunmen ran up to the Navy from behind and opened fire. Bags' truck and body were riddled with bullets. Stray bullets went flying through Majesty's house and almost hit the little kids in the yard. Bags died with his gun in his hand. He must have seen him coming, but it was too late. I didn't want to cry, but it was hard not to. I couldn't control it. P, I want to show you something, Majesty said. He went into the house and came back with an 80-page spiral notebook and handed it to me. What's this? I asked. It's one of Tupac's notebooks, he said. He left it here when he used to hang out with my brother. You need to read that. I opened it and saw Pac's notes and poems, plans, scribble scrabble, and chicken scratch. It was amazing to have Tupac's notebook in my hands. I wanted you to see this because you need to know how similar y'all niggas is, Mad said, pointing out pages outlining Pac's plan to unite OGs, community leaders, rappers, and street hustlers from every hood across America to help create more positive and peaceful communities. He had it all mapped out. Reading his notebook gave me a newfound respect for Tupac. I knew about Pac's Black Panther and activist upbringing, but now I got a glimpse of the real him. Tupac envisioned similar plans for everything that I used to talk to E-Moneybags and Majesty about, but his plan was more precise and made more sense. When I was done reading, I was at a loss for words. Looking at Madge, I felt pain for him. He lost his brother Stretch, who was murdered in Hollis in the late 90s right after Tupac was killed. Somebody shot up his MPV minivan and Stretch crashed into a tree. And now he lost his best friend, Bags. On the way home, I thought about how Hav's dogs went crazy when they saw Bags the day before. Could it be they sensed something? Maybe E had an eerie energy that the dogs could feel. R.I.P., my nigga. After Bags got killed, I was upset but had to stay focused. I had a beautiful woman and kids, money, cars, jewelry, fashion, fame, power. And since I wasn't abusing drugs and alcohol, I had my health. I felt unstoppable. I finally learned how to defeat my sickle cell pain and was living proof that sickle cell could be controlled with a proper diet and healthy lifestyle. It took a lot of discipline and self-control, but I was now living pain-free. It felt like a natural high. Anybody who'd experienced the destructive lifestyle I had been living and then made that 360 change would know exactly what I mean. I called Queenpin and asked her to play a part in my murder music movie. During the scene when she got out of a Range Rover and pistol whipped a dude for selling drugs on her block, Queenpin stepped onto the curb the wrong way in her heels and broke her ankle. In show business, there's a saying, break a leg. Queenpin must have taken that shit seriously. Just kidding, QP. The foul part was, we didn't even use those scenes that she broke her ankle filming. Half of the movie was complete when my director, Larry, pulled some bullshit. Our verbal agreement was that I would play a small part in his film Statistic, and in return, he would help direct and film Murder Music for 5% of the profit. My lawyer drafted a contract for Larry to sign, and we met in Manhattan to look the agreement over. Larry took the contract to his lawyer to check out and suddenly stopped picking up my phone calls for several weeks, which turned into months, after I had already spent $300,000 of my own money on the project. I deserve more money and credit than this, Larry insisted when he finally got back to me. He said if he didn't get what he wanted, he wouldn't finish filming, and he had all the film that we shot. It turned into a big legal battle. I felt like kicking myself in the ass, not to mention Larry's. The movie was delayed for a year, and I was so furious with Larry, and more so with myself, that I became self-destructive. $300,000 of my own money, and this dude was refusing to finish filming and withholding my film reels until I agreed to his terms, or at least came close. I asked Hav for a cigarette. That was the beginning of my downward spiral into the old poisonous lifestyle that took me so long to shake. At around 1 a.m., I went to my bedroom, turned my stereo to Quiet Storm radio show on WBLS, old school R&B slow jams, and turned off the lights. The only light in my room was the dim glow from the stereo system equalizer and tuner. As I laid relaxing to the old school sounds, I saw a black shadow-like figure walk across my room. It looked like the Black Spider-Man. No face, no features, ghost-like, all black. Scared, I pulled the sheets over my head and forced myself to sleep. When I couldn't control the way the film was going, I lost my mind. It seemed like that shadow was all the negativity that I had flushed out my mind, body, and soul, just waiting for an opportunity to jump back inside of me. And it did. The next morning, I woke up with sickle cell pain. That one cigarette turned into packs, and that occasional drink turned into bottles of Hennessy and more weed than the Western town. The evil, nasty, disrespectful bastard was officially back in full swing. Chapter 9. Infamy.
I'm a young rich ass nigga who love to show you how a nigga get his lights. Blue teach you the mystery of God and murk. You pray for me.
After recording a bunch of new music, Havoc and I got Loud Records to open a new budget for our next album in March 2002. Kiki came up with the title. Relaxing at home in Rockland, she was flipping through the dictionary and told me, "Y'all should name y'all next album Infamy." I knew it was the perfect name, and when I told Havoc, he agreed. All the drinking and cigarette and weed smoking that I started doing again, I hid from Kiki. She had cleaned her body of all that poison along with me, and I didn't want her to start back up just because I had. Plus, I was embarrassed. I wanted her to be proud of me. If she found out, she'd have been disgusted. But my sickle cell pain started to surface every now and then, so she probably knew something wasn't right. Having made this beat in the crib one day, it reminded me of Quiet Storm, because of the house music style drum pattern. Havoc didn't like it that much, but luckily, I was there before he had a chance to erase it. "This is another Quiet Storm, son," I said. "The drums are similar." "Yeah, I know, but it ain't all that," he said. "Give me an hour with the right to the beat, and I'll bet you change your mind," I said. 1 hour later, we had Hey Love, Anything. Although the beat reminded me of Quiet Storm, his guitar riff sampled over the drums and bass line reminded me of Romance and a Woman while her man was close by, so I had to whisper in her ear on the down low. When Hav heard my verse, he followed suit and wrote a similar verse minus the talking in her ear thing. Now all we needed was an R&B chorus. We decided to try and get Puffy's group 112, ran a rough version by Chris Lighty, and he agreed to get them for us. 112 listened to our lyrics and came up with the perfect chorus. We were done with the bulk of the album there, played it for Steve Rifkin, and he set up a photo shoot for the album artwork, plus a video shoot for the 112 single. A few days later, we came up with a new song that was more hood, with an up-tempo beat that sounded like some Beach Boys surfer hip-hop. We put Noid on it and called it Burn. Havoc had the idea to feature the female rapper Vita on the chorus. Vita had just signed to Irv Gotti and Ja Rule's label, Murder, Inc., so I was surprised she agreed. It was so hot, we stopped the presses on Hey Love and put out Burn first. We wanted to satisfy our core audience, and Hey Love had a crossover radio sound. Loud agreed. Hey Love targeted a female audience, even though the lyrics were still hood, especially my verse, because I'm talking about robbing a dude's woman. If that ain't grimy, then what is? This was our first album since that Jay-Z Prodigy beef, so people were waiting to see how we, especially I, would retaliate. They heard me dissing Jay on mix CDs at the Summer Jam, but this was the new infamous Mobb Deep album, so people wanted to see what was going to happen. Jay-Z told me, "It ain't no beef, it's just music." So I gave Jay some just music to listen to on Burn. Just pain, just suffering, and worse than that, you let me get my hands on you and I'm taking advantage. And that shit that you pull ain't do me no damage. You don't know me, nigga, but we about to change that shit. We leaked the song to Funkmaster Flex, who played it on Hot 97, and the DJs across the country started doing the same. Mobb Deep was back once again. A lot of people thought Jay-Z ruined Ma and Mobb Deep's career, but there's no evidence of that. We were still in our own position of power, as was Jay. Jay just made it look better because he had so much money from Rockefeller Records, and he was selling more albums than us. But we weren't selling any less than our past albums. Jay must have been pissed that radio was playing our diss record because Vita backed out of the video shoot. Well, when Vita had come to the studio to record her part on the song, I had kicked it with her and got her phone number. So I called her and asked her what happened.
"Pete, you know I love y'all, and I want to do the video," Vita said. "But Jay called Irv and told him not to let me do the video. Irv said I couldn't do it. I'm mad as hell because it would have been good exposure." "It's all good, love," I told Vita. "Too bad, though. Wow."
Wow. What was Jay so worried about that he had to tell Irv Gotti, "Don't let her do that video"? Oh, well. A thought struck me after I got off the phone with Vita. Oh, shit. That's how he got it, I said to myself. When Vita told me that Jay-Z called Irv Gotti like a little girl, it hit me that Ashanti must have showed Irv my grandmother's concert program book with my Michael Jackson picture in it. Irv must have had given it to Jay-Z. Irv Gotti probably didn't even like me because of E-Money Bags and didn't let Vita do our video. Two bird-ass bitch boys. Jay-Z and Irv Gotti. I laughed thinking about them plotting with that picture, like they had some information to destroy me or something. Scott Storch produced the last three songs for our album. Scott was a ghost producer for Dr. Dre, meaning Scott made the beats, but Dre took the credit, Scott told me in the studio. When a big-time producer like Dre takes a young and up-and-coming producer under his wing, the big-time producer lets the young one learn a lot of his tricks and helps the young one get his beats out there. The young producer usually gets little to no production credit. But after a while, he may become as big as his mentor. Scott Storch became a new hot shit on the scene when people discovered he'd been making most of Dre's bangers. We were the first to grab Scott, buy tracks, and give him full credit. On Infamy, he produced I Won't Fall plus Killer Be Killed, featuring Ron Isley from the Isley Brothers. I wrote the bridge for Ron Isley to sing. Let me tell you, Ron Isley was a player for real. He came to the studio with two fly young ladies who were singers. Ron and the ladies sang the bridge together. I was open. I wrote R&B lyrics for Ron Isley. At the very last minute, Havoc got in touch with R&B singer Little Mo, and they made a song called Pray For Me. When they played it for me, Havoc did this new style of rapping where he was cutting words in half like infamous and murder, pausing between syllables. It was unique. Nobody had ever rapped like that before. Hav left the first 16 bars open for me, and I copied his flow. The album was done. We received some bad news right before we handed in the finished product. Steve Rifkin sold Loud Records to Sony for about $80 million. And Sony dropped most of the Loud artists, keeping only the most profitable. Luckily, we were one of those profitable groups. So now, we were forced to be on Sony Records. Steve had hinted that he was going to do this when HNIC came out. He said, "I'm about to start getting into Southern rap music. I'm not signing New York artists anymore." Steve didn't give us any warning about the sale of the label to Sony, though. He basically used us as a bargaining chip, because he knew that if we found out about it, we would have fought to get off of Loud. And without Mobb Deep, Steve would have gotten less money from the sale. Sony's not a bad company. It's a major record label, while Loud was just independent. We were only upset because Sony's a huge company, and we were used to being the center of attention at Loud. At Sony, we were little goldfish in an ocean of sharks. We played it smooth, though, and let our album get its numbers. But we were quietly scheming to get off of Sony. For the time being, we had to make sure Infamy did well. And it was doing just that. Burn created so much hype that we started to get calls for tour dates. We toured overseas, and it always amazes me how much they love Mobb Deep. Alchemist became our official tour DJ and an honorary Mobb Deep member. On tour, we turned that boy Alchemist out. AKA the Red White Vulture or Red Bird, he learned how to be a vulture real quick. Because on the road, we move with that old New York Minute mentality with food, alcohol, females, whatever. Move fast or get left out. Alchemist caught on fast. The new album dropped while we were on our tour. We shot the Hey Love featuring 112 video in Atlanta. Little X was the director. The video production team wanted me to pick my love interest from a pile of models' pictures. But I told them I was going to use my baby's mother, Kiki, instead. And why not? She looked just as good as any video model, if not better. And she'd get paid for it. Kiki was open and flew to Atlanta with me. We were kissing in the video, and when it came out, people were saying, "Oh shit, Pete turned to a sucker for love. He kissing some chick in his new video." Nah, sorry, that's my woman for real. People were saying, "Mobb Deep is soft now. They doing radio love songs." But Hey Love is far from soft. It got more radio spins than Quiet Storm, and gave us a gang of new female fans. We loved it. The ladies would be lined up in the front row, and I'd find the best looking one and spit my verse, looking her straight in the eyes. So despite Jay-Z and his fans' attempt to make us look as if we lost the battle with them, Infamy sold over 800,000 copies, proving that our power and position hadn't changed. I must admit, my lyrics had become a little lazy and sloppy. I was messing up spiritually and health-wise, back on drugs and alcohol. My decision-making was terrible, and it was evident in my music. My mind, body, and soul were clouded and polluted. People who paid close attention to my lyrics were saying, "You're slipping. You're not rapping the same." And I thought they were crazy. I was arrogant, acting as if whatever I wrote to the beat was hot. I was feeling myself, or playing myself, rather. But I couldn't see it at that time. Even though I put my all into making good songs, my negative behavior was showing up in the form of lyrics that didn't grab people as tightly as they once did. My grip was slipping. After getting our gold plaque for Infamy, we did a concert at Nassau Coliseum in Long Island. Several other acts were performing that night, Backstage was packed. Walking to the stage, somebody next to me said, "Yo, P, what up?" When I turned to look, it was 50 Cent. I didn't really know 50, but it was good to see him healthy. It took him a while to recover from those 9 gunshot wounds in 2000.